Natural Solutions with Dr. J, your source for time-tested and cutting-edge natural medicine approaches to optimize your health, with your host, Dr. J. Sordian.
All right, so this is a new episode of Natural Solutions with Dr. J, and I'm very, very pleased to have the honor to have Dr. Frederick James here with us. We're down here in San Diego, and we're sitting out in alongside a riverfront, beautiful weather. And we met here at a special real estate funding event. Earlier, we've been here for 3 days, and so we were sitting next to each other, and I discovered a lot of very interesting things about Dr. James here. So,
well, thank you very much.
Yeah,
thank you.
I'm so happy that you're here.
Well, I'm glad to be here, and thanks for the invitation to have a one-on-one discussion with you.
My great pleasure, because when we were just talking informally, there was so much I go, wow, I have to just share this with the listening audience, because you're insight that Natural Solutions with Dr. J came out of the idea of it's a sort of a medical program, and because you have many years in the medical field, but you're also in a whole other arena that came from your thinking about how you could help support, because you're a pediatric cardiologist.
Yes,
right?
yes, absolutely. It's interesting that, and you mentioned the whole area of medicine. You know, it's a huge area, and I am also in another area that's huge, and that's finance. So the question comes up is, how do we think about this, and what does this mean in terms of the individual? And having given that some thought, brought together why I'm spending my time after I no longer practice medicine from the standpoint of taking care of patients, I asked a question, or then where am I going from here?
And so you were practicing for decades.
Yes, for decades.
So could you just give us a little snippet about your background so the audience has an opportunity to understand your great expertise and where you're coming from?
Sure. I'm a pediatric cardiologist trained to take care of children who who born with heart disease or acquire heart disease after birth, and that has been my 100% of my activity in this field. So,
and that was as a private physician initially, and then also working in hospital settings, and also as the department chair. So yeah. I think you said.
Yes. What I did, I was at the university, so I was in what we call the triple threat, and that is participate in research, teaching, and patient care.
So
that meant
triple threat. I've never heard that before. Yeah,
but during this period of time when I was taking care of patients, I became interested in socioeconomic status and as well as health status, and done some work on that. Spent some time in epidemiologic study of childhood obesity very, very early, when we begin to recognize that. So I recognize that it's interesting that people who were economically challenged, income challenged, which means we call it low income,
right?
They had their health status was different than those people who are obviously have higher income,
have more wherewithal, and that type of thing.
That's correct.
Yeah.
So
there was some aspect of obesity or some other factors that you felt were directly related to that, which are health factors.
Yes. Well, yes. That I consider all obesity, asthma, and all of the illnesses that I saw are really like leaves on the tree. Looking at a root cause, then it identified the relationship. Usually we talk of health in one silo, and we talk about income, finances in another silo,
right,
but we never make the connection. However, But there is a direct connection. It's surprisingly that we don't make that connection, because
not at least not enough to make a change or something. Well, you mean in the medical field, there's not that much discussion about it. It's kind of a novel approach that you're doing.
No, that's right. Not in the medical field. From the standpoint of how is it that the people who have low income have poor health status,
right?
And paying attention to that. So when a person came into my office, generally I focus on the health aspect, right. You know, the medical aspect.
Right. Uh-huh.
Okay, and write prescriptions and indicate that, well, if you're obese or if you're gaining weight, you have to stop that, change your diet, and so forth. But never thought about how a patient could accomplish that.
Mm. Oh, that makes sense.
But then beginning to study that and seeing where health and finance are directly related, that as your health improves, we find that people's finances improve.
Ah.
And the other side of it, as income improves, health status improves. And the opposite of it works too. If your health status is decreasing, your finances decreasing, your net worth decreases.
And if it's your health decreasing, that's because, and this is in children or in adults anyway?
No, in the population.
In the population overall.
Yes. Children are directly related. Children's outcome are related to their families, their parents. Okay?
Right.
So if their parents have low income, kids will suffer.
Right.
Because
of the food choices and what they can afford to eat.
That's right, the environment and what they can do to prevent as well as improve their health.
Uh-huh. Mm.
So that relationship is very interesting, and the data that's in the public sphere identifies it. It's of interest that the relationship goes all the way up to the high income earners.
Huh.
That an income earner that may be high, but just a little bit lower than one above, health status is less. Health status is less than the one who has more money.
Interesting.
See?
So it's not, very interesting. Is there a particular cutoff where the health is really great? Is there a number that exists that would?
The line is that the more money you get,
right.
It will improve your health, but it will flatten out at some period of time.
I see.
But I do believe that it's also related to the environment. You can only improve the environment so much. For whatever environment you're living in, you can only improve it so much. If I have a health problem, and I have the money, then I can seek out what is the best.
Or you can move away from a place that has more toxins or more factory smoking stuff, right?
Yeah. Or have better or an environment that has better procedures,
right.
And better medicine, and so forth.
So you discovered these larger issues in society, and you were beginning to apply that in the clinical practice to patients who you actually saw. And what was the background behind your conclusions and how you started approaching this issue then?
And when I did take a step back to look at my life, and the reason I did that is that I came from a family that I never said that we were poor, because I think poor or poverty in to me is a mental issue. Okay? There are lots of times I didn't have any money in my pocket, but I never considered myself poor.
Mm.
So, but I've never been homeless. I could eat. I had transportation.
Right.
Okay. But I made a decision to be a doctor when I was in seventh grade in school.
Mm. Where was that?
But this was in, I was born in Arkansas. So I went to early school. I went to a school in Arkansas.
Uh-huh.
And I said I wanted to be a doctor. There's a story around that.
Yeah.
Not knowing anything about cost and so forth.
Right.
But I did know that two things I did have. I had time and energy. And I knew that I would have to take time and energy and convert that to money in order to accomplish my goal.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah.
So.
And was that something that your parents, you discussed it with your parents, or you just kind of came up with that on your own, you think?
Well, I didn't sit down and, we didn't sit down and talk about it, but I learned this methodology that I want to talk to you about from my parents and relatives, specifically my aunt and my mother.
Ah.
Okay. And what I did learn, I learned that it's important to track your money.
Mm-hmm.
So I could remember from a very, very young age that whatever amount of money I had, let's say at the beginning of the week, at the end of the week, I could reconcile my pocket. You know, I knew whatever I had in my pocket, if it was less than what I started with, the difference, I could identify where I spent that difference.
Oh, all right. Very good.
So
very good.
That was tracking.
Right. Exactly. Very much so.
And I also knew that that going forward, I you needed a purpose. And going forward for me, and what led me forward, was the decision that I made about what I wanted to do. And that decision, I think, categorically, is a reason that I was able to finish high school, I was able to finish college, no debt, and I was able to finish medical school and only had about $3,500 student debt.
Wow.
Okay.
Now, that was in which decades?
Well, I finished medical school in the mid-60s.
Mid-60s, 66,
yes.
Right.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And maybe medical school was a little less expensive than it is now.
Oh,
relatively.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
But also income was...
That's true.
Was less than
right.
two.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah. So you didn't do any scholarships, or did you get scholarships, or did you?
I got one. Had one or two scholarships, uh-huh. but that was not that was not what got me through school. Relatively no debt.
Uh-huh.
What got me through school was a strategy that a friend of mine, a colleague of mine, told me.
Mm.
And what he told me was this. He said, Fred, if you do
this
not have...
This is a medical school colleague.
Medical school.
Yeah.
He said, if you do not have money to go to school, if you don't have money,
right.
or your parents don't have money, okay, and you want to go to medical school, what you do is this. You've got to find a profession that you can work during the summer, make enough money to pay for your subsequent school year.
Right.
And so that's what I did.
Huh.
I went off and I found that profession, and he was one of them. It was called medical technology.
Oh, all right.
Okay,
yeah.
I became a lab tech. Clinical lab tech.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. Yeah.
However, he told me that just when I was graduating from college, and I wanted to go to medical school.
Yeah.
So I said, well, that's what I'll do. And I went out to try and find a place.
Right.
So, and then I only had 30 days because in June, school ended in June. Program started July 1.
Medical school then?
No.
The programs. The technology.
For technology
right,
training.
Right.
Okay. And so I went around the city, San Francisco, even in Oakland, trying to find...
Because you'd moved out to Oakland by then.
Yes, I moved as a teenager. I moved to Oakland when I was 14.
I see, all right.
I was 14, 11th
from
grade
Arkansas.
In school. From Arkansas.
Yeah.
Okay. So that, and I worked, and I always worked.
Yeah.
And so I did get this advice. I went out looking for a place and could not find a program, particularly when it's starting 30 days later.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But I went to Letterman Hospital.
That's Naval.
The Army.
Army.
Okay.
That's right.
Went to Letterman Hospital in San Francisco.
And that's in like the Presidio.
The Presidio. That's right.
Yeah. Closed it since, I think.
They have. Yeah. It's a different, it's no longer military now. But I went to him and told him my story. And he said, well, and I showed him my transcript and so forth. And he said, and I told him my story from the standpoint of saying, this is a strategy that I want to use because I do want to go to medical school.
Right.
And he looked at me and he said, okay. And then after he looked over my papers, he said, you need to be in medical school. He said, why don't you, but I don't have any positions for training in medical technology. Mm. They all filled up.
Right.
So, but come back in a couple of days and we'll see. So I went back a couple of days and what he said, well, he says, I was trying to find out if you would, if we could get you paid some sort of way or even work for free. But for the government, you cannot work for free for the government.
Sure.
He says, but this is what I have to offer you. He says, I'll pay you $1 a day. That's $5 a week.
Right.
The program was a year long.
Wow.
And he says, that's all I have to offer. He says, would you take it? I said, well, let me think about it. Yes. So I took it. So I worked for $1 a day. For a year.
This is after college.
After college.
Right.
Okay.
So it was a gap year, like a huge gap. It's a monetary gap.
Tremendous gap. So obviously, I had to get. And I had this job still at Kaiser Hospital that I was working while I was working in college. I kept that job for a few.
Like what? Orderly kind of things?
It was working in the clinical lab.
Oh, all right.
But
the one that was in Berkeley? Or?
The one in San Francisco.
Oh, in San Francisco.
At Gary Street.
All right.
You know? And they're washing test tubes and all that kind of stuff for the lab. But so that I worked that in the evening time, and during the daytime I was at the program. So that was the reason, the way that I could...
Oh, right. You could afford it, yeah.
Okay. That job ran out, and I had to go on unemployment. But anyway, it did.
Which gave you more? Not really.
Okay.
I know I've been on unemployment before.
And then the other thing too, you know, you had some requirements, so it did offer some conflict, but we worked through all of that. So I got the certification, passed the certification exam for California, and started working. And in essence, I finished that. So the next year, what I did was. I worked a full-time job and a half-time job. I worked 40 hours during the week, 20 hours on the weekend. Every hour I could get, I worked, saving up money for medical school.
So the training was for a year. And then you did
another year or something, or did you
start medical school?
I didn't start medical school until 4 years after I finished college. And in that period of time, I also got a teaching credential. So I taught in high school. So I taught high school in the daytime.
What were you teaching?
Science, biology, and math. And then what I did was... I found a nice job in the lab that gave me 40 hours a week for 20 hours of work. And then I worked 20 hours on the weekend. So I was working 2.5 time jobs, accumulating money. So when when the time came around that I could apply to medical school, get all my bills paid up and so forth, when I went to medical school, so I had my money. And also...
For the entire medical school? For the four years or just for a year? And then you had to work
for
still?
For the year.
Yeah.
And then I will come back in the summer and work, make enough money, and do the same. So that's how I made it through.
Very interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah.
But it could not... but it was all because I had a goal.
Mm-hmm.
And at many times, you know, during that four-year period of time, there was attractiveness. I said, well, I'll just get a PhD and in biochemistry and so forth, and or I'll just work at, I'll be a teacher. Or I was offered to go in business with a friend or a colleague. And so I had all these offers, these exits, good exits.
Tempting you.
Yeah, it was all tempting there and saying, come this way. But I stayed on the course because this is what I wanted to do. And all during this period of time, the question comes up is how did I manage my money to accomplish that kind of a goal? Because guys came out of, I should say, students came out of medical school at with me and after had tremendous debt.
Right.
Even at that time. So when I looked at it, I coined the term, the way I was able to do it, I used a process that I now call power spending.
Power spending. Now, while we're at it here, let's make sure that we tell us all the name of your book so that everyone knows that and they can already, like, having a chance, they might be driving or doing something else. I don't want you to, like, get in a car accident, but you can always replay this again when you hear the name of his book. But this is a central theme in your book.
That's correct. After taking that, looking at that 40,000-foot view of my life there, and now the experiences, I gleaned, I derived from that a method that was being used, and covering very simple principles, concepts that we all know about. Don't spend beyond your need, your means. Your spending should be goal-directed, not just spending, but spending goal-directed that brings value to you. Okay, so I then collected this with the experience from coaching and put it in a book that I called "Spend, Don't Save," and
very controversial title.
Very
And the spend, the S is a dollar sign for the spend.
That's correct. Yeah. Spend, don't save. And the process that you use in order to accomplish what you need to do is I call power spending.
Power spending. Okay.
Now, there are certain things that obviously goes against the grain on this. Well, number one is that I'm saying don't save, and everyone says save.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Exactly. That's why it's so controversial. Catches the eye.
And then it also it is being provocative and confrontational, because we live in a society where we the government and also people in on business side are saying, we want you to spend. Okay?
Very true.
And the economy depends upon spending.
Consumer spending is 70% of the economy. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And then we are saying spend and save. The two don't go together.
Right.
Okay. So I think that's what causes the confusion.
Mm.
What it is that whenever you're dealing with money, the only use for money is to spend it. There is no other use for money other than to spend it. You can burn it for heat, but it won't last very long. But money is to be spent.
Mm-hmm.
And you're and to have an economy, you must have the spending.
A circulation of currency.
You've got to circulate it.
I think it has to go at least 8 times or 10 mm-hmm. times through the hand before it gets back, something like that. Yeah.
Good. So what happens is that, so if that's the case now, then what I need to know is how to spend.
Right.
So I need to know what is wise spending. And therefore, when I spend without purpose, meaning that for goals that I have set that's being of value for me or my family and so forth, when I spend otherwise, when I spend just because I have money without any sort of major direction, it means that I am helping someone else's goal and not my goal or my family's goal. So you spend for direction, okay? And when you do spend, that means for direction, that means that you are in control. I am deciding that I spend for this because it is good for me and for me to reach my goal. All right, that's power.
Yeah,
that's where the power
is. I understand. Very interesting. Okay. Yeah.
So that is what. So that is what I teach. Teach children this, and I counsel adults on this, in the power spending process, is that when you spend according to purpose, you spend according to that which reaches your goal, then that is wise spending, and the way that you create wealth is by wise spending. Not by saving, but wise spending.
A course that I took a while back, they talked about one method of allocating your funds into like six different jars called the jar system. And so then you divide those jars. One is for education. One is for special funding. There's two of those for an adult. Like one might be you're saving up to buy a house or a down payment or saving for a car or something else. And then there is giving, and that could be 5 to 10%. And there's play. And so there is that area where you would spend, and part of the play is there you're supposed to spend it on something you normally wouldn't spend it on. So you feel more rich. Now, this is like millionaire mind thinking, but there were these different categories. So there's the financial freedom account, which is where maybe 30%, you put 30% of what's left over after you've just dealt with your basic needs. That's food, clothing, shelter, and you know whatever else. Whatever else is left, then you automatically categorize it, put it into those percentages, and then use it for that purpose. And so the financial freedom account is supposed to accumulate. Now, you could use part of the proceeds of what you've made off of that money, but you aren't supposed to spend the principal because you want the principal to get larger and larger and larger. And that's the largesse or the, you know, what you'll live off of in the future or be able to pass on to family. But anyway, that was one system. And I know with my, after I went to that thing, I taught it to my daughters. I should use it more myself. But my daughters, and so we went to like the bank, you know, the co-op credit union, and they each went up to the cashier or the desk, and they each opened up the accounts, and they have like six sub-accounts. And it's actually served them very well. My oldest daughter really is like, she knows how to manage money because we didn't give her lots. Like she would, there was texting. All her friends had some texting thing, you know, and I didn't even have it. I didn't know what it cost, what the average amount that someone would use, you know, in a month. And so I made her do a research report. Now, this was like in sixth grade or fifth grade or something. I said, well, you know, I have no idea. I can't say whether you can have one or not, or we'll pay for it. So you go out and ask five of your friends, and you find out exactly what their plan is and what it costs and how much on the average, and then we'll talk about it. And so she did it. She wrote this little report. And I felt like it was a way to help train her, because if you're going to try to get money or funding of anything in the future as an adult, you may have to write a report. You have to research it and actually convince somebody else that let's do this. So it was from that standpoint, but also I had no clue. And I thought it might, like, she might not end up doing it, so I would never have to pay for the texting. But she did.
Okay.
She did. And it was brilliant. And she came back, and it was all, you know. And so we discussed it. We decided to go with one plan. And then 1 month it went way over, and we had to discuss that. I was able to, like, get the plan to cancel out the overage, but I think we went to a slightly larger plan or something.
Uh-huh.
But that's kind of a couple of the ways that I've tried to work with my daughters. Because I really didn't get a lot of education. I mean, we had our allowance, and you work for money and special chores and things like that. But actually having a way to allocate out into particular goals, essentially it's that way, but it's this percentage for each one and sort of wrote. You just like whatever's left, you just divide it out into that. And so they would go in and whatever savings they'd have, maybe they get birthday gifts and this and that. And so then they go into the co-op and they'd have their little piles of different money and the person's there going, wow, this is very impressive.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
But so I think that's also a purpose.
Yes.
You know, you're spending into that account with a particular purpose.
Purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's right. That's good. The good thing about what you've just described is, one, is that money is tied to a purpose. That's good. Okay. And then two, and after the allocation, the spending has a limit.
Right. Very true.
So, therefore, you are addressing the issue of excessive or overspending.
And
it's not someone telling you that, but you are seeing it yourself. Uh-huh. You're seeing, and you're making the decision. Mm-hmm. That's true. I use in the books Spend Don't Save. I use a method, identify method, similar to what you. Simpler, but because I looked at how do we spend money?
Yes.
If all the money that we spend, everyone spends, where do we put it? Where does it go? And I found it's four different areas.
All right.
Four.
All right.
Okay. One is that we spend money for our daily care. All right.
Right.
All right. That means your food and your board and, you know, all the things that you need to operate daily.
Yes.
Okay? Two is that you spend you reserve for expenditures later. You don't spend them now, but you're going to spend it later.
Right.
So that's the.
Maybe like
car,
saving up for the car, the house,
you know,
or some down payment,
yes. And so forth.
Uh-huh.
So, so I call that reserve. You know?
All right.
Is
it earmarked or it's just?
Well, it's
not
it's,
earmarked.
It's yes, it is earmarked
because there's a goal.
There's a goal.
Right.
Because the first thing you do, you find that the category, and that's reserve.
All right.
And then the third category is contributions. Okay.
Right.
Okay. And then the fourth is. Investments. All right. So those are the four categories that we spend money.
Uh-huh.
And a number of us feel that, like on the investment side, if you purchase something, I mean, if you are invested in something, you're actually purchasing something. So you're spending money for that. Okay.
Right.
So now.
So that's part of the power spending, using the word spending.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, that's right. When I have these four categories, now I can look at my life, my existence, you know, my environment, my family, and so forth, and find out, okay, what are my needs that's going to be falling into these categories? So that's where the goals come in. Well, where do you want to be?
Right.
The 3 years from now, 12 months from now. Well, what is that you want to accomplish? Okay. So once you have that, then you say, okay, well, how am I spending money now? And then, once you find out how you're spending money now, then the next question you ask is, will this spending support the goal? If it doesn't, what changes do I have to make in order to accomplish that?
Right.
Okay? So that's why the spending pattern, fine. So, and then once that decision is, then you say, well, okay, how much money am I coming into the household, and then in order to reach this goal, how much money will I need in these four categories?
Uh-huh. How much? Now, what are the categories again?
Invest. Contribution.
Uh-huh.
Reserve. And expense.
Expense.
Okay. Yeah. So, how much money will I need in this, and that? I must put some money in each category every time I get money.
All right.
See?
Uh-huh.
All right.
Right.
It's not that, well, this paycheck goes in, but the other paycheck goes someplace else.
Right.
No. That's the money to the household. This is the spending for the entire household.
Uh-huh.
So I look at I said, well, okay, to accomplish that goal, then I need to put X percent in this category, X percent in this category, and so forth and so on, right? And when I put this money in there, is to take care of the needs of that category, okay? And I don't borrow one from the other.
Is it a percentage kind of thing?
Yeah. What I identified is that in the contribution, investment, and reserve category, an initial goal should be at least 10% each.
All right.
10% of your discretionary, the money that you have in control of.
Right.
10% each go in those categories.
All right, so that's 30%.
That's 30%, right. And the 7% goes into the daily.
Right.
Into your expense category. Yeah. Now, to determine the health of your financial health, if you are spending of your discretionary money, if you're spending in the expense category more than 70%, you're in trouble.
Yeah, I see. Uh-huh.
You're in trouble. Uh-huh. Okay. So this is a concept that I teach adults. This is a concept I teach children. So whatever, I don't get into the allowance, you know, whether you should get an allowance or not. I leave that political thing up to the family.
Political. All right, yeah. That's interesting.
What I do say, I tell the child, I said, whatever amount of money you get, wherever you get it from, gifts, allowances, working, and so forth, you take that money and you're going to divide it percentage-wise into each of these categories. Right? Now, and when you... So I really don't think that, unless and just under special circumstances, that I want to... I don't care when I look at your spending pattern. I really don't care if you spent $10 at Starbucks or whatever. I really don't care. The thing that I do care is that you do not exceed your allowance for that particular category. So that takes, from my point of view, that takes care of overspending.
Oh, all right.
Okay.
That's very interesting. Yeah. So people can get your book where?
They can go on Amazon.
Amazon. Repeat it again.
Amazon.com.
Right.
Spend, don't save. Are Barnes & Noble.
Very good.
Spins on days in hard copies, ebook, and also
ebook on like Kindle and somewhere else.
That's correct.
Right.
Through Amazon. The other is that go to my website. It's called powerspending.com. Powerspending.com. And there,
that's powerspending.com.
Academy.
Academy.com.
That's correct.
All right.
Okay.
PowerSpendingAcademy.com.
That's correct. And you can order, you can get a link right directly to the page and order it from.
All right. Perfect. And you also, do you do group classes or do you do one-on-one or what?
Yes, I do.
Because you say you teach students and children and adults.
Now I've written a curriculum for a 4th through 12th grade.
Oh wow!
So the fourth to sixth grade is a specific curriculum, and then for the seventh and greater grades, 7th to 12th, is a different curriculum.
And so, is each of those curriculums standalone? Or is one supposed to progress to the next? But if they somehow missed the first curriculum, then they get caught up on the second?
Yes, it is better if they are... what I find is if I got the child at fourth, fifth, or sixth grade and they got the middle finance, what I call it, it's called middle finance curriculum, they can advance, irrespective of what their age is and their grade, they can go into... the curriculum that I would give the older child.
Oh, I see.
The advanced curriculum. Uh-huh. Okay. But I do get some seventh graders who don't know the concepts.
Right.
And so they have to receive a compressed but appropriately directed material for them to get them up to speed so that we can talk.
So is this, have these implemented somewhere? Is there any school system that... Has the great good fortune to have adopted your system? Or?
I offer this at a homeschool campus.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes, where parents who are either have their children in charter school
down
in Orange County. It's called the Contra Costa County. It's called Homeschool Campus Orange County.
Oh, but it's Contra Costa?
Costa Mesa.
Oh, Costa Mesa. Yeah, I was going to Contra Costa up in Northern California, which is where Oakland is.
That's right.
Costa Mesa.
Costa Mesa.
All right.
It's the Costa Mesa campus.
So they actually have a homeschooling campus?
There is a homeschooling campus, yes.
Wow.
And we're parents from charter schools and families who are homeschooling can bring their child, and they have a whole program of teachers, a staff of teachers. Independent, offering classes, and I offer a personal finance class.
So they can
select that, and that forms the classroom.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so beyond those basic principles, if someone's doing that and they have their investment category.
Yes.
Then you also... Are you a financial advisor too?
No, I don't. The section that I pay attention to is to prepare a person to go to a financial investor advisor.
Uh-huh.
See, that's because many of us go to financial advisors and we're not prepared for it. So I do the preparation.
All right. And so what is it about the typical person who isn't prepared because they don't have any funds or they just don't know how to manage?
Yeah, and it's not necessarily income related. You know, you're living paycheck to paycheck. And there are many high earners living paycheck to paycheck.
Oh, that's true. See? That's very true.
Yeah. There is a... when I look at the articles... this particular case, and this is not an atypical case, it's a common case, you know. The physician making $450,000 a year, and they gave his expenses. I analyzed it with using the power spending method, He's living paycheck to paycheck. He is in trouble. He has 90% of his income going in a direction that...
Which is just expenses.
Just expenses.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. But if you use this method, it will allow you to find out what decisions you should be making that you have to make in order to write it. And the other thing about this system is that if you use it, you'll always have money. You'll always have money. Because in the investment, if you put in regularly money into the investment account, I don't care how much it is, just put money there. It has a capital base that you don't touch. And it is to be working for you.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And you'll have reserves. The only category that is allowed to go to zero is your contribution category and your expense category.
Oh. Yeah. That would be nice if my expense category was zero.
That means that you... That means
you don't spend anything on food or...
Well, no. You've already spent it. You've spent everything in that category, so you have no more money left in the account.
Oh, I see. Right.
And that's okay. You may not have paid all your bills.
Right. Oh, all right.
See, that could happen. That simply means you're overspending.
Oh, I see. Right. Yeah.
So what you want to do is that you... you're allowed to bring that account to zero. Okay. And the contribution account is zero. And why? Well, the contribution account is that you're supposed to be contributing. You're not supposed to be letting it sit there in an account.
Right. Oh, I see. That makes sense.
And the contribution account and the investment account, they both are investment accounts. Right?
Hmm.
And the other two are a spending account. One is delayed And the other one is deferred. The other one is current.
Oh, interesting. So, if people, besides buying your book, that's one way to learn about your system, or going to your classes that are down here. Are there other avenues, or is there some other contact information people should know, should have for you?
If they go to the website, they will have access to, number one, the different coaching programs, uh-huh. which can go, they can be a one-on-one coaching if they want, can be a group coaching, it could be a teaching class. I'll even train what I call facilitators to teach finance to other people. You know, is primarily focusing with the child because I have the curriculum. I can train them on the curriculum, and they can teach that curriculum.
Ah, that would be a good thing for a lot of schools to have.
Yes. So that,
because that was a conversation around the hearth last night. That people were saying, oh, yeah, my child doesn't even know how to balance a checkbook, that kind of thing, because financial literacy seems to be not taught in the schools.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing, you know, around the fire that we were talking, but balancing checkbooks and using credit cards and debit cards is the last thing that I teach in the class. Because what I want you to do, I want you to know about the environment that you are in, and the writing of checkbook balancing. That's a technical issue.
Yeah.
And so
it's just a surrogate for cash.
That's right. Yeah. So what you want to do is, you need to learn how to do healthy transactions and what information you need in order to make healthy decisions financially. So, and that's what I teach.
Fantastic. Well, I'm so glad you had the opportunity to speak to us. I hope this all works well. I mean, I may edit this very last part out, but only this part that I'm just blah, blah, blah. But it's great to have you on.
I think this is a
really key component of health, as you said. The healthier everyone's finances are, the healthier they can be in other ways.
That's correct. This model works for the resources that you have. It works for time. It works for your energy and your money. So the same four bucket system, you can use it to manage your time, to manage your energy, and to manage your money. So we spoke primarily of the
about money, uh-huh.
about money side uh-huh. of it.
So those are all covered in your book also, or those are the next editions?
Yes, the use of the system with your resources, time, energy, and money is in the book.
Wow, great, I can't wait to read it.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
To buy your copy of Superbrain, Maximize Your Brain Health for a Better Life, go to superbrain-thebook.com. That's superbrain-thebook.com. Information can also be found on naturalsolutionswithdrj.com.